You that are here to this talk this evening. As you know, this is the fifth one in a series, the fifth as far as prehistory is concerned, and you will be aware, because most of you have attended all these meetings, that we dealt with prehistory right up until the emergence of mankind. Tonight, the title is From Hunter to Farmer and the Neolithic Revolution, the Natural Division of Labour and the Subordination of Women. Now, strictly speaking, the reference to the Neolithic Revolution is really a reference to tools, because lithic relates to stone, and Paleolithic is old stone, Neolithic is new stone, and Middle Lithic or Mesolithic is the middle stage. And this all relates to a transition from roughly chipped stone tools to stone tools that were polished and finished. Now, nevertheless, the corollary to the transition from Paleolithic tools to Neolithic tools, the corollary was the transition from food gathering and hunting to food production. And in relation to the question of tools and crafts and so on, I shall be dealing more specifically with that in the next talk, which is entitled Mankind the Toolmaker. So what we're considering this evening is this. We're considering that for over a million years during the Paleolithic and middle stages of culture, mankind lived by hunting and collecting wild plants. Now, this food-gathering economy was gradually supplemented and eventually replaced by one of food production in the Neolithic stage, beginning at least by the 8th millennium BC. That's about 8,000, maybe 8,500 to 9,000. And it began in southwestern Asia. And the centre of this revolution was between 30 degrees and 40 degrees north, and it stretched for about 1,000 miles from western Iran to Greece, including parts of Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Anatolian Plateau in Turkey. In this area, wheat and barley grew wild, and it still does, as far as is known, which led to the beginnings of agriculture. Here also lived the wild ancestors of goats and sheep, which were probably first domesticated in the Middle East. Now, wild cattle and pigs had a much wider distribution and were domesticated later, probably from different centres, from several independent centres. The change from hunting to farming laid the foundations of civilization. And I may add that the switch from gathering and hunting economy to one based upon agriculture was an essential basis for the subsequent industrial and technological revolutions. It was also the spark that ignited the population explosion, as it's been called. Because of the distribution of resources in the world, a gathering and hunting way of life allows for a maximum world population of around 20 to 30 million. Anyway, this is the kind of calculations that have been made. The greater concentration of food produced by organised agriculture multiply that figure many times. It stands now at over 4,000 million. And apparently it's still rising. And I may point out that it's not by agriculture alone, but by a combined worldwide social production. Comrade Hardy, for example, last week when he gave his talk on political economy, he pointed out, of course, in relation to productivity, that whilst the people working on farms were getting less and less, nevertheless, food production was being carried on by society, and that people in engineering, producing tractors and so on, were also indirectly producing food. So that of course, this has been a social production in modern times. The revolution, the Neolithic revolution, or the transition from food gathering and hunting to food production, also brought in its train the division of society into classes and the subdivision of the subordination of women to men. That was on a basis of sex differences. The corollary to this was the natural division of labour, and I'll deal with that later on. It created organised warfare on a large scale, a large social scale, as a corollary to the production of large surpluses, which were, of course, above individual requirements. And for the last 10,000 years, mankind has witnessed the most appalling intraspecific inhumanity. And that's something which didn't exist in Paleolithic times. And this increases in the intensity, bloodiness and aggression through the evolution of culture. And, of course, it reaches its culmination in modern civilized times, that's today. The possibility of warfare gets more horrific as time goes on. Now, we've pointed out that food production is the hallmark of the stage in human social development known as the Neolithic. And Neolithic people constructed permanent dwellings, sometimes within fortified villages and even towns. Their activities included the systematic mining of flint and obsidian. Now, as you know, or you should know, that a certain amount of mining was done by Paleolithic man. But in Neolithic times, it became more systematic. And the manufacture and trading of polished stone, axe heads in particular, and their use in clearing forests for agriculture was on a systematized basis, where you had actual stone implement producing factories. Quite a number of new crafts were also developed. Basketry, stone vessels and pottery, spinning and weaving. And the Neolithic had a period, an Aceramic period, about 7,000 to 5,000 BC. Yes, I'm going to explain it, if you just wait a minute. You're as impatient as the people in Hyde Park. An Aceramic period refers to a period without pottery. But nevertheless, in the Middle East, wheat and barley and pulses, flax and fruit, and in the Far East, rice and millet. And in Central America, it was maize. These were the three main cereals that laid the basis, the foundation of food production. Now, according to radioactive dating, the earliest Neolithic towns and villages in the Near and Middle East, such as Çatalhöyük in Turkey, Jericho and Yarmo, were approximately contemporary with middle or Mesolithic hunter-fisher camps in Europe. For instance, Star Car in Yorkshire. You've probably heard about that, or if you've been to the Natural History Museum, you would have learned something about that. And this was dating from about 7,000 BC. So you've got to understand that it's not a simple proposition where it was the same all the world over. The development took place on a more piecemeal basis, so that it coincided with, in Britain, it was a bit late, as it were. Now, apart from the Nile Valley and the basin of the Euphrates and places where there was a periodic flooding, which brought about a settled civilization, Neolithic farmers at that period tended to use a simple slash-and-burn method of cultivation. And, of course, it necessitated frequently to move to new tracts of land when the soil on the old became exhausted. And that in this they were in similar situation to the hunter-gathering peoples who moved on when the game and wild food became temporarily exhausted. In relation, for example, specifically to Egypt, of course, Egypt is a very, very special case. And when, of course, people go and look at the pyramids, they obviously, most of them, don't take into account that the pyramids represented or do represent the lives of thousands and thousands of slaves. However, we'll go on. The expansion of the population took place, of course, and Neolithic culture soon spread from its nuclear areas in the Middle East and the Mediterranean basin, went up the Danube Valley, over much of the lowlands of Germany, and as far as the Middle Elbe, the River Elbe. And this was all before 4000 BC. 1,000 years later, it reached the shores of the Atlantic, the British Isles, and southern Scandinavia. The first farmers, according to, well, as far as I'm concerned, I've not read any anthropologists that deny this, apparently, and of course this is not something that can be absolutely ascertained, but it's a question of scientific deduction, the first farmers were apparently peaceful. But warring groups appeared in parts of Europe towards the end of Neolithic and early Bronze Age times. For example, the warrior pastoralists who brought the battle axe culture into Western Europe about 1900 BC. As I said earlier, the term Neolithic, New Stone, implies a certain stage of culture, not an absolute period of time. The earliest Neolithic of the Middle East was contemporary with the Mesolithic Middle Stone in Europe. The later Neolithic of Northwest Europe existed at the same time as the Bronze Age. Urban civilization of the Middle East, the Neolithic stage lasted from about 7500 BC to 3000 BC and from 3000 BC to 1800 BC in Britain. The Polynesians, when they reached New Zealand about 1000 years AD, were in that period of Stone Age culture, and when Europeans discovered New Zealand, they were in it then and persisted in it for quite some time after that. But in Britain, the Neolithic began with the arrival of farmer immigrants. But these newcomers did not replace the Mesolithic hunters. So when we start talking about immigration, I don't think the people who are talking about immigration take this into account. If they did, of course, it would mean that they would have to transport the whole of the population to wherever they came from, which is a bit of a mystery. These newcomers did not replace the hunters and fishers who for some time continued their way of life much as before, and only gradually assimilated the elements of Neolithic economy. It was thus that the so-called secondary Neolithic culture arose, represented, for instance, by the chip-flint areas, or rather chip-flint axes, known as Thames Picts. And I'll deal with this in greater detail in Mankind the Toolmaker, because a description and a consideration of tools is quite a complicated proposition. So I shall be dealing in greater detail with that later on. There was a settlement, for example, at the Orkneys, at Scarborough, and the stone axe factories also seem to have been worked by people of secondary Neolithic culture. Now, a strange thing about this was that artistic expression seldom, if ever, reached the heights of the Paleolithic cave paintings. Neolithic people were, of course, non-literate. Writing was invented during the Bronze Age. Their religion appears to have been founded on worship of the Earth Mother Goddess, symbolizing fertility. And for a further consideration of this, I would recommend The Evolution of the Idea of God by Grant Allen. Probably the greatest achievement of a non-utilitarian nature in Neolithic culture were the lavish decorations of pottery. Very, very stylized, and of course the construction of elaborate tombs, figurines, and at Chatalhuyuk, and amazing wall paintings and plaster reliefs. The idea of building megalithic stone tombs under mounds of khans originated in the Mediterranean region with the beginning of the Bronze Age, before 3000 BC, and was adopted by Neolithic people in Western and Northwestern Europe. Now, the moment of birth, or the time of birth of truly modern man, is very difficult to pin down. As you appreciate, when we discussed the emergence of man in a previous, or mankind, shall we say, in a previous talk, it was very, very difficult to find exactly when Homo sapiens emerged. But generally speaking, apart from the fact that there's some controversy as to what is meant by the term, however, biologically, a group of some 40,000-year-old skeletons found in the limestone cliffs in France, some 300 miles southwest of Paris, are the first examples of modern humans. But it could be argued that it was only when agriculture was becoming well established that modern man truly arrived on the scene. And that depends, of course, how you look at it. And I would like to stress this point because, on the one hand, we have a biological distinction, on the other, a cultural one. And whilst we cannot disregard cultural developments in Homo erectus, nevertheless, Cro-Magnon mankind, was the first example of modern man biologically with regard to such questions of anatomical features, morphological and physiological attributes, which have not drastically changed as far as can be assessed scientifically, that is, in about 40,000 years. And it must be remembered that Cro-Magnon mankind was at first Paleolithic man, so that Homo sapiens carried on where Homo erectus had been operating, as it were, with the kind of tool making that developed on a Paleolithic basis. And they were hunters and food gatherers, of course, with a different culture. and therefore they had different behavior to Neolithic mankind. The evidence points to the fact that Paleolithic man was, on the whole, peaceful. Neolithic man, on the other hand, became increasingly warlike. And bearing this in mind, we need to be very critical of attempts to depict mankind as an aggressive animal genetically programmed for killing. For instance, Professor Raymond Dart, who I mentioned earlier on in connection with the emergence of man, Professor Raymond Dart, who was the discoverer of the first australopithecine, who in an essay entitled The Predatory Transition from Ape to Man, wrote of our ancestors' alleged proclivity for killing. And I'll quote. He says, "On this thesis, man's predecessors differed from living apes in being confirmed killers, carnivorous creatures that seized living quarries by violence, battered them to death, tore apart their broken bodies, dismembered them limb from limb, slaking their ravenous thirst with the hot blood of victims and greedily devouring livid, writhing flesh." Needless to say, this same learned professor who wrote this lurid fantasy was the inventor of the crackpot theory of an osteodontocratic culture. And that means a culture based upon bone, teeth and horn. And of course, when you read some of the stuff, well, of course, I can only conclude that it is a crackpot theory, although he was quite serious about it. Now, we've already noted earlier on that food production was the hallmark of the Neolithic period. Every food plant of major importance was grown in the Neolithic stage of culture, just as all the main animals reared for meat today were domesticated during this period. You see, early man was not so backward as some people try and lead us to believe. Most of the essential inventions of modern society were based upon the discoveries and the technical advance not only of Paleolithic man but also of Neolithic mankind. And you could say that that civilization today is really an extension of the Neolithic technology, insofar as there was a transition, a revolutionary transition from food and gathering, hunting and food gathering, to food production, with the consequent production of surpluses, which of course became the reason for the kind of behavior that we've found over the last 10,000 years. Plant cultivation may have started before stock keeping. There's no evidence that mixed farming was practiced very early in the Neolithic. In all probability, agriculture was at first mainly the concern of women, whereas animals were domesticated by the men whose traditional occupation had always been hunting, while the women gathered vegetable food. Very likely, grain cultivation started accidentally. Wild cereals would have been collected from afar and brought to the settlement, where seeds would have been dropped, and the inhabitants would in due course harvest the crop. You see, it's similar, as a matter of fact, to eoliths. Eoliths are stones which are already present in their natural form and are used as a tool by an animal or by a human being and have not been purposely constructed or made. in relation to food gathering. It's a food production, rather. It's a similar sort of process. The purposeful sowing of seeds would have come much later, on a question of cause and effect. The advantages of cultivating plants were probably first realised by groups of food gatherers, such as the Proto-Neolithic peoples. And that refers to the people, pre-Neolithic people, as distinct from Mesolithic people. They were in the initial stages, as it were, of the Neolithic culture. That's the reference to Proto. They were living a fairly static existence on the grassy uplands bordering the arid plains of the Middle East. And in this area, the annual grasses included wild forms of wheat and barley. The reason for that is that these particular species of wheat and barley are tolerant of low rainfall and yield large enough grains in sufficient quantity to encourage harvesting. Now, there were some experiments carried out in Turkey by J.R. Harlan in 1966 on the distribution of wild wheats and barley. And the book that was written on this subject, The Wild Harvest in Turkey, showed that the harvesting of wild cereals could have made a very significant contribution to the diet of pre-Neolithic peoples. Using a flint-bladed sickle, this same chap that wrote the book, he gathered enough wild wheat in an hour to produce 1 kilo of grain, which incidentally proved to be almost twice as rich in protein as cultivated wheat. A family working for, say, 3 weeks when the wild wheat was ripe, he suggests, could gather more grain than they could possibly consume in a year. And such activities, together with hunting and fishing, would explain how people like the Natufians, who, of course, I know you don't know who they are, but they're the people I mentioned earlier that were resident on the arid plains. That was their specific name. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't mean a lot, but it's another group of Neolithic peoples. And people that were resident also on the Euphrates in Syria. They would have been able to settle in one spot without cultivation or domestication, necessarily, as a systemized operation. And wheat and barley were grown together at all early Neolithic sites. And they were both fundamental to the new economy. As you, of course, must know, their grains are highly nutritious. They can be easily stored. The return is high, and the labour involved is seasonal, allowing leisure for other occupations such as art and the development of basketry and other forms of production. Deliberate selection of the best seed for sowing and accidental crossings of varieties produced grains very much larger than the seeds of wild grasses. So from that, of course, they would get the idea of periodic sowing. Now, in relation to wheat, the origin of the cultivated wheats has long been the subject of speculation and inquiry. As far as modern botanical and archaeological evidence suggests, that the cultivation of both wheat and barley began in the Near East. The process of development from wild grasses to high-yielding modern wheats is imperfectly known, but it has involved gene mutations, hybridization, and chromosome doubling. And this process has taken thousands of years. Now, I dealt with in my talk on natural selection and Darwin and Wallace, I dealt with genetics to some small extent. And of course, what has happened as far as wheat and barley and other cereals is concerned, you've had a process where artificial selection by man, as well as natural selection, under the diversity of climatic conditions, there's been, as it were, an intervention on the part of mankind as far as genetic structure is concerned, a kind of genetic engineering, which of course was not recognized as genetic engineering. It was just a question of selection of certain types of wheat and continuing to grow those. But of course, what happened was the emergence of a certain kind of wheat, Tritium. And this is classified in three groups. One, the diploid group. You know what that is because I discussed that previously. Diploid, of course, means two. The diploid group with two sets of seven chromosomes consisting of icorn, which is a wheat, this is the sort of the name that it's well known by, and two, the tetraploid group with four sets of seven chromosomes, and this is a type of wheat called Emma wheat, and several others, and three, the hexaploid group with six sets of seven chromosomes, and this comprises the bread wheat. Now, the three great cereal areas of the world are based on the cultivation of wheat, rice, and maize. All these grains, of course, are rich in energy, producing carbohydrates, and the most ancient civilizations arose among the growers of wheat and barley in the Near and Middle East. Later came the rice growers of Southern Asia and the maize growers of Central America. And for a long time, the evolution of culture in these three areas was independent, so that the sweet potato is the only American food plant known to have passed into cultivation outside America in pre-Columbian times. Maize, the Irish potato, sunflower, tomato, French lime, and runner beans have attained their worldwide cultivation since then. And similarly, wheat, barley, rice, and soya bean were unknown before that time in America. So that you can see that with the development of the Neolithic Revolution and the dispersal of this kind of culture to many other parts of the world, that this had a tremendous effect upon the future of mankind organized in society. The carbohydrate-yielding cereals are native to areas where also leguminous plants or pulses, beans and peas and so on, also grow wild. Together with oil-producing plants such as flax and various roots and fruits were cultivated in Neolithic times as well. Now, barley also grows wild everywhere in the Near and Middle East under many different ecological conditions and overlaps with the two varieties of wild wheat in the region of Syria. Possibly, barley first came into cultivation accidentally as a weed in the wheat fields, and it is found at Neolithic sites in the same levels as wheat. In other words, it was, according to the evidence, it was grown as much as wheat and at the same time. Other cereals found at Neolithic sites, millet, earliest known appearance about 3000 BC in Iraq, It was the main crop during Neolithic times in the Far East, particularly China, therefore ranking in importance with corn as a basis of early civilization. Oats and rye were not cultivated before the first millennium BC. Germany and Switzerland, both plants probably first appeared as weeds in wheat fields. Rice, the growing of rice, which of course became the staple diet of tropical areas to the extent that you had people often saying, well, how do you pay your Chinese with a handful of rice? This involves, of course, a more continuous labour process than grain cultivation. And it evolved from a wild kind of rice, which was native to the East Indies. And probably rice was cultivated in India earlier than in China. It appeared in China during the late Neolithic, about 2000 BC. Millet was the main crop grown during the late Neolithic. This period in China, but imprints of rice husks were identified in pottery from the Neolithic settlement of one place in China, Yangshaotsun, if I've pronounced it correctly. Now, maize, fossil maize pollen, was found at a depth of about 200 feet in borings beneath Mexico City, dating from the last interglacial period. You know, of course, what the glacial and interglacial periods are because I dealt with that when I dealt with the succession of life in geological times, coming to the Pleistocene, which was a series of glacial and interglacial periods in the Northern Hemisphere. And this was at least 80,000 years ago, and these pollen grains are very, very scarcely, they're scarcely distinguishable from those of modern maize. But strange to relate, there's no living wild plant which can be identified with certainty as the original ancestor of cultivated maize. And that was the cereal on which the pre-Columbian civilizations of Peru and Central America were based. And the explanation for that is probably that wild plants would not have been able to survive the effects of certain characters of cultivated maize conveyed to them by wind pollination. You see, cultivated maize is unique among the cereal grasses in that the terminal male tassel is widely separated from the lateral female ears. Kernels are enclosed in leaf sheaths, and there is no mechanism for the dispersal of seeds, and with the result, of course, that cultivated maize can't be produced or cannot reproduce itself without mankind's intervention. And the oldest known remains of maize came from Cox Catlin Cave in the state of Puebla, Mexico, dated by radiocarbon to be about 5,000 BC. And the cobs of this maize were very tiny and uniform in size, which suggested that they were either from wild maize or maize in the earliest stages of domestication. Cobs from another cave in New Mexico, dating from about 3,600 BC, were still very small, and it seems that maize may not have been the earliest plant to be cultivated in America. Plants as gourds, lima beans, and squashes were probably grown in America before 5,000 BC. And of course, beans, peas, and lentils, all producing plants, olives, castor oil plant, lesame, as it's called, rape and flax, linseed, fruit, dates, olives, and grapes, all were grown. These were found, rather, evidence of this has been found, as well as carbonized apples found at Chatelhuick around 6,500 BC. and grape cultivation began in the mountainous regions of North Mesopotamia, Syria and Palestine, where vines grow wild, and it reached Italy during the first millennium BC. Domestication of animals. Sheep and goats were first domesticated in the homeland of their wild ancestors, which was also the Middle East. And when wheat and barley were first cultivated in this area, it may be that animals gradually became attached to mankind for protection and for the food he was able to offer them. But however it occurred, there is no certain evidence as to whether stock keeping or plant cultivation came first. It's an academic point. I don't think that it matters whether it was, cereal growing or domestication of animals. The fact is that they were very, very closely together. They more or less arose at the same time in different areas. In some cases, possibly hunters may have taken to herding stock. In others, the reaping of wild cereals probably led to their cultivation. Dogs may have been the first animals to be domesticated by Mesolithic hunters. At present, however, the earliest known date for any domesticated animal is 8,900 BC, which is quite an age. And that is for sheep. And both sheep and goats were kept by early Neolithic peoples, proto-Lithic Neolithic peoples. Cattle and pigs were reared slightly later. Probably they became associated with mankind through raiding its crops. It's clear from such sites as Yarmo that mixed farming began very early. A stubble left after reaping would have provided good grazing for animals, which would in turn benefit the crops by their manure. Now, animals were first valued for their meat and hides, and as they became more docile, they would have been milked, and finally they were used as pack animals. And by killing off the wildest rams and bulls and preserving the more amenable selective breeding, the animals that were more amenable, selective breeding would have begun. Now, mankind encourages various characters arising through mutations, which in the wild state would be unfavorable and which would die out as a result of natural selection. So that here again you can see it's a kind of genetic engineering unconsciously carried on. Examples of the behavior that was selected are docile behavior, conspicuously colored coats, and long hair. This is some of the characteristics that were chosen. And of course, this is in marked contrast to what's happened to human behavior. Mankind, with the domestication and selective breeding of animals, has been able to intervene in the process of natural selection and bring about genetic changes by artificial means. In the case of mankind, where natural selection has virtually ceased to exert any crucial influence, no significant genetic changes have taken place over the last 40,000 years. But mankind's behavior has changed alongside of changes in social relations. The overall net result has been that, in contrast to domesticated animals, which have become more and more docile, human society has become more and more warlike. Of course, the ideal situation for modern society, for capitalism, is to have a working class whose behavior can be switched on and off at will genetically, from docile to warlike behavior. This would overcome the inconvenience of learned behavior, with the possibility that eventually the working class would start thinking in terms of their own interests. Many experiments must have been made in trying to tame various kinds of animals, which were to prove unsuitable for domestication. The Egyptians, for example, tried to tame antelopes without any great success, gazelles, monkeys and hyenas, also without much success. The ass, Equus asinius, was domesticated in Egypt from the Nubian wild ass, and it was the earliest pack animal, and its relative, the onager, was harnessed to wheeled vehicles in Mesopotamia about 3000 BC. The horse, and I mentioned the horse in some greater detail earlier on, as you will remember, from a small Hyracotherium right up to the modern species Equus. It was domesticated probably in northwestern Asia and spread across the Western world in the Bronze Age during the first half of the second millennium BC. The only domesticated animals imported in Neolithic times were the four food animals, which still provide main man's staple diet: sheep, goats, pigs and cattle, and also the dog as a companion and a hunter's aid. And in spite of their importance, I'm not going to go on to say very much more about them. I think I've given you enough data to recognise that what an important process the Neolithic Revolution was in many respects. First of all, it was the means of a tremendous technical advance in human relationships and living. But on the other hand, the contradictions were, of course, that it brought with it class society. So I'm not going to say very much more about animals, except that in the case of dogs, it seems that they were first tamed from wolves by Mesolithic peoples in northern Europe from about 7500 BC. And apparently all of this, as I mentioned earlier on, all of these species of dog that now exist were all initially derived from wolves. And the earliest evidence of goats came from Jericho and another place in Iran before 6000 BC. Domesticated goats were derived from the bezoar, which still lives wild in the mountains of southwestern Asia. Sheep, earliest of all domesticated animals, sheep, they were present in northern Iraq about 8900 BC. Domesticated sheep, they are believed to have been derived mainly from the mouflon. And there are three forms living wild in Europe and Asia still. Pigs, the domesticated pig is descended from the common wild boar. It might be boar, P-O-O-R as well. But among the oldest known remains of pigs are those from pottery levels of earlier Neolithic sites. But no domesticated cattle have been found in Aceramic levels. Domestic cattle are descended from the wild aurochs, Bos primogenesis, whose bones are common in deposits of Pleistocene age in Europe, Asia and North Africa. The bulls were very large, up to 6 feet high at the shoulder. I don't know whether you've seen any photographs of an aurochs, but they're very much like the cattle now, only very much larger with huge horns. Now, that's about all I'm going to say about the Neolithic Revolution. Obviously, it is a period of great importance. Possibly I've gone into too great a detail, which is a bit boring, but nevertheless, it's necessary to know something about it. I've not mentioned anything about tools or crafts, of this period, because I'll cover this in greater detail in the talk on Mankind the Toolmaker. I want to say something about the natural division of labour and the subordination of women.
Can I ask a question before you carry on?
Yeah.
I missed right at the beginning. You didn't give a date. You must have done before I came.
A date for what?
The sort of period in which this...
Yeah, about 8,000 BC.
And how long did it take for the whole thing to develop?
Well, I mean the Neolithic period as such ended with the Bronze Age. Mm. Now, in relation to the subordination of women as a social group, and this arose, I contend, largely out of the development of property relations, and it was made possible by the existence of the natural division of labour in relation to food gathering and hunting. In primitive Paleolithic society, both food gathering and hunting is necessary for living and, of course, survival. And the reason why women became the food gatherers is not because women were regarded as inferior socially. The reason why they became food gatherers and men the hunters was because the necessity of a long period of afternatal care in relation to children obviously fell naturally on a biological basis to the lot of the women. And so women were confined to a closer vicinity of the camp. And because of that, they were able to forage near the camp for food and take the children along with them. Hunting, of course, is a much more difficult operation. You don't want children crying out or being trailed on whilst you're trying to run for miles on end, or while a hunter is trying to run for miles on end, tracking game. So that specifically it became a man's occupation. On the other hand, men who were away great distances and for longer periods of time on hunting expeditions, and judging from the study of hunter-gatherer peoples still in existence, for example, the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, food gathering requires only a bare minimum of equipment. The basic tools include a pair of unworked hammer stones to crack nuts and a sturdy digging stick about 3 feet long, about 3/4 of an inch in diameter. This was sharpened to a blade at one end. The most important item of equipment was a kind of a karos, a combination garment and receptacle made of antelope hide, which the women wear draped over the shoulder, and it forms a pouch for carrying nuts, berries, edible roots and bulbs, as well as ostrich shells, water containers, firewood and babies. So that this one garment had a multiplicity of uses, but it was very, very simple, of course. And these three simple items are all that is needed to obtain vegetable foods in the Kalahari Desert or similar geographical areas. On the other hand, going after animals demands more ingenuity, and a correspondingly more elaborate set of tools, including bows and arrows, poisons, arrow poisons from crushed beetle pupa, ropes, snares and nets, fire-making kits, knives, and a dozen other items. And the most commonly caught game, as far as the Kalahari Bushmen are concerned, the spring hare, and it's rather a complicated process. Rather, this spring hare is taken in its burrow with the aid of a flexible pole about 13 feet long. The hunter pushes the pole into the burrow, and slowly as it bends to follow the underground turns, proceeding by feeling it, by feel and the vibrations, and always ready to detect the vibrations or sounds that indicate the location of the cornered prey. And then, at the proper moment, he moves the pole backward in a swift thrust, which impels the hare